Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and biffs football giants on the nose. I'm 2-0 at the Etihad, Kevin Day, and he is Liverpool University's 2-2 at Anfield, Kieran Maguire. Not too shabby, Kieran, and it's our 200th episode. I don't know which is more of a miracle, Palace and Brighton getting points yesterday or Saturday, or us reaching 200 episodes.
I think possibly the latter, because at least Brighton and Palace have got professionals associated with them, whereas we're a couple of old South London blokes who still can't work out where the on button is on our computers.
We're currently running about 17 minutes behind schedule because we had to record, obviously, the sponsors advert and couldn't manage it. it took several takes to, first of all, press the right button, as you say, and then to read out some simple words correctly. We've got one quick news story, Kieran. It's questions day, but we have one quick news story, and this is a couple of teams have done this recently. It's almost becoming a theme, but Blackburn Rovers training ground has been sold to a new company set up by the club's owners, Venky's London Limited.
Yes, and this is a case of it's a bit like getting your tax return in on the 31st of January to avoid paying the fine. The EFL changed the rules on the 1st of July this year, which meant that if you sold a property asset at a profit, it could no longer count towards the profitability and sustainability rules, what people normally refer to as FFP. So we have seen other clubs use that particular, I think loophole is an appropriate word, given that you weren't allowed to do it before 2016. They changed the rules in 2016, and then we've seen Aston Villa, Reading, Birmingham, Sheffield Wednesday, Derby County all mysteriously sell their stadiums to companies connected to the club owners. Blackburn, under the Venkies, have been spending ludicrous amounts of money compared to what they actually generate, and they were in a genuine danger of breaching financial fair play rules. So just before the 1st of July, they sold the training grounds for £16.6 million, and you've got to give credit here to local reporter Rich Sharp at the Lancashire Evening Telegraph, and I'm sure when people get jobs as football journalists, they didn't expect to spend their time trawling through companies' house records and land registry records, but he did a fantastic piece of work to snap this up. So is this good news or bad news? Well, it's good news from an FFP point of view. I think we've already said that we're a little bit twitchy about separation of property assets from the football club itself. The new company which has been set up, and I'll do my best to mispronounce this or pronounce this, Venkateshwara London Limited, was set up with just £1,000 worth of shares. So not sure where it got the £16.6 million from to physically buy the ground, but I'm sure the two parties will come to some form of arrangement with regards to that. But it is good news in the sense that Blackburn have been spending I think it was £187 on wages for every £100 that comes through the door in their most recent accounts. And therefore, they were having to very much mind the pennies to make sure that they didn't go into a breach of FFP. I'm sure that they've had the training facilities professionally valued, and therefore this is a market value, and therefore it should qualify under the old FFP rules at the EFL.
Look, Kieran, you quite rightly praise the local journalist who's been investigating this, but if you know that the new company's only technically got £1,000 and they're just buying something for £16 million, and he knows it, well, why haven't the EFL spotted that and asked for explanations?
Well, one can only presume that the EFL will get involved in this when the accounts are published. That's when they do their formal assessment. Yet for all we know, there could have been correspondence between the two parties. They're under no obligation to put this out in the public domain. So, if Blackburn had been smart, they would have probably given the EFL a heads up, say, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, this is the price, which we've had confirmed, presumably by a professionally qualified surveyor. And it's going into our calculations, and the EFL will go, well, okay, as long as it's done by the 30th of June, you're fine. A couple of days later, no chance.
Okay. Now, on to questions. And this is where I wish I could do impressions, Kieran, because our first question comes from James Stewart.
I was thinking the same.
I could do a passable Michael Caine. Not before the others, not after the others, with the bloody others. And I do a very good impression of my Auntie Pat, but no one will know how good that is. So. But James Stewart has a question about valuations, and it's a very valid and topical one. James says that Mike Ashley sold Newcastle for around £300 million, but the figure talked about for Arsenal around the Spotify bid was £1.8 billion. What in particular makes Arsenal £1.5 billion more expensive than Newcastle?
Okay, when you value any business, and it doesn't have to be a football club, ultimately the value is going to be determined by the estimated amount of cash that the club is going to generate positively in future years. And when I say positively, I mean revenues less costs. So as far as Newcastle are concerned, one of the cash measures that I use is something called EBITDA. And if you take a look at Arsenal over the last 6 years, they've generated over £500 million in this particular measure, profit measure, whereas Newcastle's was £130 million. So that means that Arsenal are generating around about four times as much money as Newcastle. So therefore, you'd say, well, that gives them a four times valuation. Why is it a six times valuation? Well, the other thing that you take into consideration is risk. Now, whilst Arsenal have been a bit bobbins in the last 4 to 5 years, they've never really been in danger of being relegated. But if I was looking at Newcastle in the Ashley years, the club was physically relegated twice. They've had a poor start to the season, so therefore you'd factor that in as well. And what you do is you say the more the risk associated with the investment, the lower the value. So you put those two features together, and that gives you Arsenal being worth 6 to 7 times as much as Newcastle. There's the London factor as well, which means that you can extract more money from sponsors because people like coming to London. That's not disrespecting Newcastle, right? You and I, we've both been to Newcastle. Fantastic place. But from a business point of view, how many big corporations have their head office or even satellite offices in the northeast of England? It's not happening. So therefore, they're more inclined to sign up with London. Arsenal have got a bigger stadium. They get far more match day income. In a good year, Arsenal will make more than £100 million in match day income sales compared to Newcastle's 25. There's another elephant in the room. Arsenal have continued to invest in their facilities over the course of the last decade. And one area which I think we've highlighted where Mike Ashley in particular has been very tawdry is his refusal to put money into the stadium, into training facilities, into the academy, into medical facilities. So the new owners have got an immediate cash investment to catch up. It's a bit like, you know, if you've got two houses side by side and one of which has gone into disrepair, you'd pay less for that house because you think, I've got to go and spend a load of money tarting it up.
Yeah. Did you say EBITDA?
EBITDA.
What does that stand for?
That stands for earnings before interest, taxation, depreciation, and amortization.
Oh, I was right. That's what I've written down here.
Ah, we are married too long.
No, I'll tell you what I've written down here. I've written down EBITDA, Doctor Who character, ? is what I've written down. And underneath that, I've put possibly Welsh detective. The chances of me actually working out what that acronym stood for, Kieran, was slim to none. Our next question comes from Ben Watson, if it's the ex-Palace player Ben Watson, then hello, Ben. And if it's not, hello, Ben. Ben's question is an interesting one. They're all interesting questions. I don't know why I bother to say that. Ben says, how much of an effect do the public stock markets have on football clubs? If corrections and or bear markets appear, does that affect football clubs' abilities to make investment in the clubs, e.g. players, non-playing staff, facilities, etc.? And for those of us who are not au fait with stock market parlance, Kieran, what's the bear? I've heard the phrase bears and bulls, obviously, but what's a bear market?
A bear market is where the viewpoint of shareholders and investors is that things are going to take a negative outlook. And therefore it tends to be associated with a reduction in the value of shares. Whereas a bull market is where everybody gets a bit giddy and it's a buy. Eddie Murphy's Trading Places, I still maintain, is as good a proper analysis of the way that the markets do run. That there is very much a herd process in their behaviour.
I wasn't expecting that sentence to be used today, Kieran, but the Muppet Christmas Carol is actually a very accurate representation of the book. So, These things can happen. Ben's question then.
Ben's question, yes. There are two types of ways of buying and selling shares in the form of football clubs. In terms of public markets, it's where you or I could go onto a website, and if you want to buy 1,000 shares in Manchester United, in Juventus, I think in Borussia Dortmund, in Ajax, in Celtic, and so on. These clubs have their shares publicly traded, so therefore there is an active market where people are buying and selling shares on a daily basis. The other type of company is called a private company, and the only way that you can buy shares in that market is if you go to an existing shareholder and say, I'd like to buy some of your shares. This is what I'm prepared to offer. And they've got the opportunity to sell, to say yes or no. So those transactions tend to be much fewer and far between. With regards to Ben's comments about a bear market, and as you're right to push back on that in sense of, what's it mean? It means that the shares in general are falling in value. I don't see that impacting upon a club's day-to-day activities, because if you take a look at a football club, especially a publicly traded club, where is it getting its money from? It's getting its money from broadcast deals, from the sponsors, and from selling tickets. That's completely independent of a bunch of dweebs with spreadsheets deciding that a particular share in a football club's overvalued and therefore selling it at the existing price because they think the price is going to go down. So the two things are, certainly in the short term, they are completely independent of each other. In the longer term, if Manchester United decide that they want to raise, say, £300 or £400 million in a few years' time because they want to invest in better facilities, in more infrastructure spend, or to fund more spending in the transfer market itself, then it would become an issue. Because if the share price has gone down, if you want to raise £400 million, then you have to offer more shares, and that's going to mean that the existing shareholders, their shareholdings are going to be further diluted, which tends to become a bit of a vicious cycle.
I was fairly convinced that a discussion of bear market would have led us to the Blackpool nightclub, Kieran, but we're obviously both in a more mature frame of mind this morning. Our next question comes from Brendan Nevin. And Brendan Nevin says, when are parachute payments made? Are they given to clubs as soon as they are relegated, in addition to their Premier League finishing position prize money, or are they made at a later date?
Well, Brendan, they're made at a later date. Ultimately, this is part of the distribution of monies by the Premier League. So therefore, if you are relegated in 2021-22, then the parachute payments are your entitlement to a share of the TV deals for 22-23, 23-24, and 24-25. And the way that the Premier League distributes the money, and here I'm going slightly on hearsay, slightly on trying to persuade one or two people to tell me a bit more than they'd probably like to, is that the Premier League makes a big payment to all of the clubs, including the Premier League clubs themselves, but and those clubs that are entitled to parachute payments during the summer. It's normally in July. Sometimes it could be the end of June. But it's normally in July, and that money is useful for a few things. First of all, you know, the clubs have got wages to pay, and they're not selling tickets during the month. But also, from the perspective of the TV companies, they've got to fill space during the summer. One of the ways of achieving that is the transfer rumour mill. Yeah. So if they give money to the Premier League, who in turn gives it to the clubs, it allows the clubs to go out and sign players, you know, to pay those first instalments, and it gives Sky and BT something to talk about. So there's, as always, when it comes to money in football, you might say, well, it's very generous of the TV companies to give so much money up front. It's in their self-interest to do so. So when that money is given to the Premier League, I reckon around about 60% of it then probably goes to the individual clubs as a first instalment of what they're entitled to over the year. And therefore, that would be given to the clubs in receipt of parachute payments as well. And then I think there's sort of two or three instalments spaced over the rest of the year.
Do you know if there's any flexibility in that, Kieran? Because like in my world, actors... writers, comedians sometimes will, if they've done a job, finished a contract, and the money's not due for 4, 5, 6 weeks, occasionally the agent will go, well, I'll tell you what, I'll pay you. And then is there the flexibility, you know, if a club is in serious financial trouble on relegation, could they go to the Premier League and say, is there any chance we can have some of it now? Or is it just, that's not possible given the amounts involved?
No, that wouldn't be possible. But remember, we have discussed on quite a few occasions where clubs have gone to lenders and say it's a glorified and this upsets people in finance when I say it's a glorified form of payday loan, but it is a glorified form of payday loan no matter how they try to dress it up. And they say, well, we're entitled to money for the next 2 to 3 seasons from the Premier League. These are the due dates. Are you as a bank prepared to give us that money now? And then when we receive the instalments from the Premier League, we'll give you that money back and we'll be paying you interest on top.
Okay. Richard Bushell. Hello, Richard. Richard says, you often focus on the costs of players, but how much do clubs spend on terminating manager contracts early, and how much is paid out when poaching managers from other clubs by way of compensation? Also, and this is a very interesting part of the question, what's the legal basis for this? Because you don't hold a manager's registration in the way you do for a player, or do you?
No, you don't hold the manager's registration, but managers signed fixed-term contracts. Now, if the club dismisses the manager, and unless that they can prove that there has been gross misconduct, then the football club is in breach of contract, and the manager is entitled to compensation for that. So what will normally happen is the club will make an offer to the manager. The manager will say, well, that's a bit crap. And therefore probably approach the LMA. The LMA will go back to the club and say, you're in breach of contract. You know, our member has worked. There is no evidence of gross misconduct. And therefore we think you should pay him up. And then the lawyers get involved. And you know, the football club, I think my understanding is that they have to put something out in terms of try to go through mediation. They'll often make a derisory offer, so the manager will reject that. Then it will go to arbitration, and then you reach this final settlement. So it can get quite ugly. I know when my club Brighton when they dismissed Gus Poyet, that was for gross misconduct by all accounts, and therefore no settlement was made. So it can be financially beneficial to the club. In terms of poaching, it can never be proved. You have to go through the correct protocols. But again, normally a club knows when it's going to sack a manager, and will start to put feelers out in place before the manager is sacked. If the manager that they are approaching again has a fixed term contract, then the club would be able to say, well, if the manager leaves, there's a breach of contract, so we are entitled to compensation. So therefore, you're not transferring his registration; you are giving the former employer compensation for breach of contract, and that tends to come from the clubs that's doing the poaching. And it's in everybody's interests for this to actually go through relatively smoothly, because the last thing you want is for the club that's on the receiving end to start getting arsy to say, well, we've got a contract of employment, we therefore are going to stick by it, and we're going to threaten to sue you, and it could make things very ugly. So as soon as the clubs start to realize he is a goner, he's a dead man walking, and we know where it has happened with clubs recently in the Premier League, for example, then wheels are starting to take place behind closed doors.
If you talk to some of the more, shall we say, veteran ex-managers, Kieran, who are still littered about the punditry business, it seems that poaching managers was a much simpler process back in the old day. You just met someone on a motorway station service bridge, accidentally dropped a huge packet of cash, and then gave me a phone number. That seemed to be the way to do it. So it always makes me laugh when Sky say so and so have been given permission to approach another club. It's like, really?
Well, the approach has already taken place.
Of course it has.
Because why bother to approach the club unless you sounded out the manager?
Yeah. Well, technically, it can't happen, so it doesn't.
Technically, it can't.
Yeah. We'll let producer guy sort out the legal niceties of that last bit.
We know that producer guy has been talking to both Michael McIntyre and the Swiss Rambo on a number of occasions. We just leave it at that, won't we?
Oh, of course. And we also know Guy, for all his loyalty, if he was approached by another podcast, he'd be, bye, boys. It's been a lovely pleasure. Thank you. I'm off to L.A. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
And now it's time, Kieran, for our weekly game of being bamboozled by a fairly simple-looking surname. And also, I'm guessing this is an Irish name, Kieran. And
as, yes.
As both you and I know, that working on the basis that none of my cousins can actually settle on a uniform way of pronouncing our own surname. I'm going to go Sean Lehan, but it could be Sean Lehane, or it could be Sean Porth Call. You know, you don't know. That'd be more Welsh than Irish, but L-E-H-A-N-E. He's a Plymouth fan, let's put it that way. Sean Lehan. I'm going to go Lehane. Sean Lehane. I'll give all the options. Producer guy doesn't bother to edit any of it anyway, does he? So Sean says, in an update earlier this year, Plymouth Argyle owner Simon Hallett said the club's finances had been further improved by a successful claim against our business continuity interruption policy. Have you heard of other clubs being able to do this? And what sort of payout might such a policy typically make? For example, would it cover the lost revenue from matches where tickets and hospitality had already been sold, as the case was with us before Exeter, just before the first lockdown? This is something we talked about at length when lockdown started, because a lot of clubs simply couldn't afford the premiums for this sort of policy, could they?
Yes. Business interruption insurance is normally there for if there's property damage. So, yeah, if you have a flood or a fire and therefore you're a restaurant and you can't open, it's a way of allowing the business to pay some of the other bills whilst the infrastructure issues are being dealt with. However, some business interruption insurance policies do cover what's referred to as, and you can tell I've done my research here, infectious and notifiable diseases. I wasn't expecting to say that other than coming back from trips to Amsterdam. was this covered by COVID? Well, there was a big test case which went through the Supreme Court earlier this year. And the good news for companies is that they do appear to be covered. It looks as if the total cost to the insurance industry is going to be in the region of about £2 billion. But you've got to really here check your small print. Now, in the case of Plymouth, I believe the settlement was around about £2.4 million. So you've got to give a huge amount of credit to Simon Hallett and the rest of his team. And I've said myself, I think as a club, I think that they are extremely well run. That's not a criticism of the previous owners, who reached a point where they couldn't continue to put the same amount of money into the club as they had done previously. We've had Simon on the show. We've spoken to people connected to Plymouth, and it does appear to be run with the aim of being a sustainable club on a long-term basis. This is sensible planning, but as you rightly pointed out, the premiums for these things, especially when clubs are living from hand to mouth, it's one of those costs where you think, well, nothing's going to happen. Fingers crossed. And that's always a gamble with insurance. For example, What if Derby County had had business interruption insurance? Potentially they wouldn't be in administration today because they would have had they've lost around about £20 million in gate receipts. And you know, all the people that have lost their jobs and the uncertainty involved and all the huge costs being run up by the administrators, those wouldn't have arisen. But they made their decision. And that's not a criticism. You know, you make the decision in business as you go along.
Yeah. Another question on insurance comes from Michael Hartley. Now, we have covered this topic before, but there's a detail in this question that I'm really interested in. And I suspect 80% of the people listening to this pod, when I come to it, will go, yes, I've always wondered that. Michael Hartley says, I've been thinking about player insurance. Is it a club or player responsibility? What do players need to do to keep it valid? I've heard players talk about not being allowed to go skiing, for example. Also, and this is the bit, why do insurance companies allow players like Jack Grealish to wear such small shin pads? And would his recent shin injury mean he could be forced to change this due to insurance going up? And it's you go to any pub before a football match on which football is on TV and Jack Grealish is playing, and half that pub will be going, why's he allowed to wear them? What's the matter with him? And then somebody will say, oh, look at his hair. Of course he wears little shin pads. but do you know what I mean? I think it's a really interesting question because I would imagine the insurance on a player like Jack Grealish is fairly hefty, and insurance companies are not wanting to pay that out, and they must have a heart attack every time they see him going on a pitch.
Well, that is if Jack Grealish is insured, because we don't know whether that's the case or not. But,
surely I would have thought, is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. My understanding is that there is a Premier League policy which all clubs subscribe to, but the payouts for that are, I'm going to say laughably small. And we're talking millions of pounds, £2 to £3 million pounds for a player who's just been sold for £100 million. But what clubs have is therefore that they've got two choices. A, they can insure players against the risk of a long-term career-ending injury. But the premiums, again, are very, very high.
Right.
And that will put even Premier League clubs off. If you're having to pay out millions of pounds a year in premiums and the average wage of a player is £2.5 million, if they pay out huge sums in premiums, would that money actually be better paid into the playing budget with a view to trying to avoid relegation or get into the Champions League? Some clubs effectively self-insure in the sense that they will put so much money aside into a pot each year. And this is what I do with Finlay's dog insurance, because dog insurance is nutty. So I've got a separate bank account, which I put a few quid into each month. And therefore, if there's the dog bills, vet bills to pay, I pay it out of that. And that actually works out a lot cheaper than the premiums you pay. So you can do a little bit of setting money aside, and this is what some clubs will do. In terms of the players themselves, some players will have taken out insurance policies, but they are very much in the minority because if you're 21, 22, you're going to live forever. Yeah, that is. Yeah, you go back. You think about the risks that we took, personally and professionally when we were that age. I can remember, playing park football, and you could take out insurance if you broke a leg and couldn't. You missed going into it. Nobody took those out. And those policies were dirt cheap, and for a professional player, they would be far higher. So some players who are a bit more cautious will go down that route, but not many of them. Again, they will see it as a fairly large sum of money that they have to pay out. In terms of clauses, there are this is the club protecting its assets. If you have paid £100 million for the registration of a footballer, then you don't want him going skiing and potentially ripping his cruciates in a skiing accident or playing other sports. You go back to when we first started going to football and the number of footballers who are also cricketers.
Yeah,
likes of Chris Balderstone and so on, and that was It was a feature of sport. But football clubs won't allow players to play cricket. I remember playing against Paul Scholes when he was about 14, and everybody knew he was going to be a good footballer. And then I think he played against us the next year. And when he turned 16 and turned his pro contract, yeah, no way was he being allowed by Manchester United to play cricket. It seemed to be a dangerous sport. So the clubs will have clauses in their in contracts of employment with players, which will say that the following activities are deemed to be at a risk, and therefore, under your contract of employment, you cannot do X, Y, and Z. Doesn't stop them being dicks in cars, though. in terms of sporting activities, there is a restriction.
I think a lot of our listeners will be surprised to learn that this insurance isn't compulsory for players. But I'm more concerned to get on to asking you, Kieran, when it comes to dog insurance, what are the clauses? because dogs have got claws.
I know.
I should know how to explain it. So is Finley not allowed to go skiing?
He's not. Which is actually, he's a very bright dog. So I wouldn't put it past him.
I was just thinking about what business Finley's had interrupted. Finley's business interruption insurance policy. So listen, if anything happens to that, this was Midsummer Murders, Kieran. This would immediately be followed by that dog being kidnapped and you getting paid a massive, and then the dog would be found in the boot of the Baroness's car. next question is from Lloyd. Now, I don't know if Lloyd just wants to keep his name to himself or whether producer guy has done it himself. It tends to happen with the third question from the end. The producer guy's interest wanes a little bit. He gets distracted by the sight of a falling £10 note dropping casually out of his mattress.
He doesn't do tenors anymore, Kevin.
He probably doesn't. But Lloyd says, with traditional broadcasting rights looking like they've reached a ceiling, you may disagree, Kieran, do you think we'll eventually get to a place where a global streaming service owns the top five league rights?
I think Lloyd is right to an extent that there is a ceiling in terms of traditional broadcasting rights, although there's still certainly domestically there is here in the UK. For the overseas market, for the UK, there is some growth. What we are seeing is, and I did a bit of research into this, and Lloyd, I think he's right, because 11 Sports, which I think is the company which is owned by Rad Rezani, the Leeds owner, they've just signed a deal to sign up and market the TV rights for 9 nations in Europe and sell them as a complete package. Now, these 9 countries are Denmark, Iceland, Kazakhstan, Latvia, Northern Ireland, Poland, Slovakia, and Switzerland. So yeah, I think individually they would struggle to get a lot of interest in their rights to sell them. As a package for people who are looking to fill space in sports channels, then they might have some value. It would have to be a very successful streaming service to effectively monopolize the TV rights for England, Spain, Italy, Germany, and France, but it could be done. I think the one thing that's likely to count against that is that there does appear to be an increasing desire by the football authorities themselves to take the broadcasting in-house partially or in due course fully and sell that direct to the consumer, as you know, we've heard it called Premflix and Premier League Prime and God knows what else, because that way they don't have to effectively give a slice of the action to the existing broadcasters. The downside of that is they're not guaranteed the monies which the broadcasters commit to them.
Our penultimate question, Kieran, comes from Liam Reynolds, and it proves yet again that one of the things that really fascinates football fans, I find, is the economics of football kits, replica kits. Because in the last 3 or 4 years, most football fans have become very aware that they're sold for a lot more money than they make to produce. And people are starting to be wary about that. And I know quite a few people who won't buy replica shirts because of the conditions in which they possibly are made. But Liam Reynolds says, if a shirt costs £50, how much of a profit would the club make from that sale? And how much of that £50 would the club receive? Second question, how much of an impact do fake football shirts being sold on eBay and other websites have on the bigger clubs' finances? I'd imagine not that much, but it would be nice to know.
Right. In terms of a £50 shirt, and the days of the £50 shirt, I think we're now sailing beyond those.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that, you know, football shirt inflation is something I will, when I do get some free time, which is quite rare, I'll see if I can track what's happened in terms of shirts, because I think they get quite a few of the big clubs are now going for £70 a pop.
Yeah, well, so Kieran, I have to point out that football shirt inflation is what happens when I put one on.
Yes, sadly. Yes, I've gone from L to XL to XXL. they got tighter looms, that's what I'm claiming.
Yeah, well, do you know what, sorry to interrupt, Kieran, but a friend of mine always says that if you're buying an XXL shirt, it should cost you 20% more than a medium because there's more material involved. It's like you'd think that clubs had noticed that, but apparently not.
No. Just wait till next year's kits come out, courtesy of Kevin Day. They'll be going. You know, we're delighted.
What was I thinking?
Yeah, I'd patent that if I were you. Yeah. The average commission we believed is around about 7 to 8%. So therefore, on a £50 shirt, a club will be making £4. But on top of that, they are getting a flat fee. So yeah. Who are Palace with Puma?
Yeah.
Yep. So Puma will say, we will pay you know, X million pounds plus 7% on every shirt that you sell. So the club's not making a lot of money on the marginal trades, but in order to get the Palace contract, we've got a contract with Nike, they will pay us so much. And Adidas, for example, pay Manchester United £75 million a year as a guarantee unless Manchester United failed to qualify for the Champions League 2 years in a row, in which case there's a 25% penalty kicks in.
Yeah. And Liverpool got a very different deal, haven't they?
Yeah, Liverpool have actually agreed a lower fee but a higher commission. Yep. They're on, it's estimated to be 20% commission on each shirt. They believe that using Nike's roster of, superstars promoting Liverpool as a brand, they've got the basketball connections, they've got some of the tennis connections and other sports as well, then that they can actually start to sell more years. Yeah, and they will have done their sums very, very carefully, because I've learned that the people at FSG who own Liverpool, if you think that I love a spreadsheet, I've got nothing on them by all accounts. Moving on to the second part of Liam's question, I think you're absolutely right. If we go down, Oxford Street, we will see blokes selling fairly ropey looking. Yeah. Fake replica shirts for 20 or 30 quid to tourists. There is a market for this, partly due to the fact that, if you're a parent and you've got two or three kids who are all mad keen supporters of club X, Y, and Z, and remember the shirts which used to last two seasons are now being changed every year, you are subject to a bit of pester power, and the costs are they're difficult to justify in terms of the cost of the materials and the cost of the cost of the labor that goes into them. So there is a market for that, but there will always be a market for counterfeit goods for anything which is a highly in demand brand, and that goes from Gucci to Manchester United and Liverpool. I don't think the clubs lose huge amounts, because everybody we've been conditioned to like the authenticity of a shirt. Overseas, I think it's perhaps more of an issue. Certainly when I've gone to some countries overseas to teach, it's not the type of shirts that you can get in these stalls in London. They look pretty authentic. And I guess that's where the clubs are losing out. But you know you're buying a fake shirt because of the price that's being charged.
Yeah, the thing is, if you go to Milan, for example, your fake shirt will be lovely, but it won't fit.
Yes.
Even their XL in Italy is a medium, essentially. Our final question comes from Gerard Hilderley, which is a great name, Gerard Hilderley. I think if I'd been an actor in the 30s, that would be the name I would have taken, Gerard Hilderley. Gerard has a very good question to end this pod. Gerard says, could you be kind enough to explain the financial decision behind Leicester City using a third party to sell back their sponsorship deal to the club? Great to see Leicester win the FA Cup, but on hearing so many pundits applaud the club for prudence and financial conduct, I was wondering if this really is the case. Now, Leicester, I think, are a club we've all grown to admire in the past couple of years, and I think none of us minded when they won the Premier League, but they've kind of pulled a number on us a little bit, Kieran. There's been a bit of smoke and mirrors from Leicester. They've presented themselves very much as financial minnows, but that's never really been the case, has it?
That's right. And to look at this story in depth, you have to go back to 2014. And what happened there was that Leicester's new Thai owners had come in. The wages had doubled within 3 years. The owners had put money in, and Leicester were in danger of a breach of financial fair play. So they signed up with a company called Trestelar, and Trestelar operate from the premises of a printing company, I think in Sheffield, and they don't have a website and they don't have a phone number. Even so, they managed to, and Leicester gave them a contract, say, will you go and sell our sponsorship rights and our commercial rights independently of the club in Asia? And they did this very successfully. They managed to get those rights up from £8 to £18 million.
Goodness.
And it just so happened that the company that to whom they sold the rights happened to be a company owned by the owners of Leicester City. Pure coincidence. Okay? Absolute coincidence.
Easily happen.
Yeah. And on the back of that, Leicester recruited well. They were promoted to the Premier League, and they went on to win it in 2016, which I still think is the most astounding achievement in terms of Premier League football this century.
Yep, agreed.
But the EFL said, we want to investigate this a bit further. It turns out that this company, Trestelar, is owned by the son and the daughter of Dave Richards, who used to be, I think, a Premier League chief executive or Premier League chairman. Pure coincidence, of course. At one point, his name was being linked with being the chief executive of Leicester. Pure coincidence.
Okay.
Eventually, if you take a look at Leicester's accounts, go into the small print, Leicester agreed a £3 million fine / settlement with the EFL in relation to financial fair play issues. But of course, by that stage, they'd already won the Premier League, and this particular issue very much flew under the radar.
It's a very interesting question. Thank you for that, Gerard. And thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution yourself to our always free to air pod, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And before Kieran goes to renew his insurance policy in case of a lack of wonky chumps for Findlay, I will hand you over to him for his customary farewell.
Well, the usual nonsense is an irrelevance. This is our 200th show, but far more importantly than this, I'm Kevin's father, Kenny, died a couple of days ago. It's an astounding achievement, first of all, for you, Kevin, to be here on the show. You must have been through an awful lot. All that I can say is that you know, I've got to know you over the past couple of years, and you know, and off air, you've always spoken about your father with such love. You've told me all the stories about him and all of the fantastic times that you've had with him. And all I can say is that from myself and from Guy and many of the listeners who've been in contact, we're so sorry about your loss. We're sending you all our love. I know it must be really tough for you. And we just want to know that we're with you and we want to do all we can with you.
Thanks, Kieran. Thank you. I appreciate. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that, and everything, the kindness I've been shown by everybody has been overwhelming. Thank you, Kieran. I'm bereft. thank you. I can't. I'm sorry. I can't say any feels, but
no,
thanks.
Okay. So, as for everybody else, we'll see you when we next see you. Look after yourselves. Stay safe. And love to all. Bye-bye. The Price of Football.
Price of Football.